friends, thank you so much for joining us yet again for another episode of What Page Are You On? It me, Bethany Rutter. I'm here with my good friend and business partner.
It me, Alex Slater.
And the format of this episode is slightly different. So in the past, we've done interviews and we've done episodes that are me and Alice talking. This time, we're kind of smashing the two up in a new way because we are joined with... Who is it?
It's Elizabeth McNeil, and I'm the author of The Doll Factory. And yeah, I'm so excited to come on this podcast because when I'm doing my glazing in my pottery shed, I'll often listen into it. So yeah.
It's nice to have a guest that is also a reader, like a listener.
Yeah.
A fan. A friend of the pod, if we may say that.
Your first pod?
I'm afraid it's my second.
No, I love
it. That's good.
I did Riff Raff a couple of days ago.
Of course, it's not your first radio.
Not my first radio, but you might think it is. Who knows? We'll see how I do.
Just pretend the microphone isn't there.
Okay.
Because we just, we chat about books all the time anyway.
Yeah, that's true.
You just have to be less bitchy.
Yeah. We'll reel it in. So we are here to kind of talk around... three books, but really one in particular, and then Elizabeth's book as well. So the theme of this episode, I looked back into my past, to my childhood, and remembered my horrible history book, which was called Vile Victorians. And I thought that was
such a good book.
It wasn't it? Yeah. Weren't all the horrible history books so good?
Yesterday, my husband asked me where I learnt a historical fact. And I didn't want to tell him it was from Horrible History, so I was like, I know stuff.
I'm smart.
Most of my understanding of history has come from Horrible Histories.
And just how they focus on such crude things as well. I mean, like, that's my kind of lesson, you know. Like, I want to, and Michel Favre as well, you know, he plumbs those depths.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's why I thought that Vile Victorians was an apt title under which to discuss your book, The Doll Factory, by Elizabeth McNeil. I'm going to keep saying your name. Crimson Petal and the White and The Apple by Michelle Faber, which are all kind of modern novels written in the 21st century that deal with kind of the second half of the 1800s. So, let's
first
begin.
Yeah. As always, I'll ask this about Crimson Petal specifically. Did you love it?
I absolutely love this book. So when I was writing The Doll Factory, I actually not only was I listening to this glorious podcast, but I also listened to it pretty much on repeat in my pottery shed.
And you listened to Crimson Petal on repeat?
Yeah, I mean it's about 40
it's 40
hours.
Hours.
Yeah,
I've, 40 I literally hours. Finished it yeah. yesterday. I finished it yesterday.
I've listened to it maybe three or four times. It's just a story that you can just sink into. I don't understand how he can make it so immensely readable when, you know, at such length and with such sort of small there are so many small character arcs which sort of lead to greater ones, but I mean it doesn't have this sort of single propulsion of
there's a cat in the room.
My cat.
There is a cat in the room. There are two cats in the room, so listen out for those little Easter eggs.
So it's basically an incredible book, and when I read it, I was working in the city the first time I read it, and I loved it so much that I actually did a terrible thing. I put a fake afternoon of meetings in my diary, and I went to a coffee shop and I just read it. And then when I came home, my husband was only allowed to talk to me for about three evenings if he read to me. So he just followed me around the house reading from The Crimson Petal and The White.
Oh,
it was amazing. I've never done that with a book before.
It's not really... I can't think of any other book like that in just quite how long it... Like, I think the ratio of excellence to length is, like, unparalleled. It's very long, but you could be fooled in thinking that it's not super long, because if you see it in book form, they print it on, like, Bible paper.
Yeah, they
it's
do.
So thin.
Yeah, and the type is so tiny. It looks like, you know when you get, like, your name written on a grain of rice?
Yeah. Because my darling husband, Paul Howarth, who is now in Norway, wanted to take some big books with him on his trip.
Uh-huh.
And I said, the best big book is Crimson Petal and the White. And he was in the Barbican Library at the time, and he was like, it kind of doesn't look that big. And then when he opened it up, it was like, I see what they have done. I see how they have fooled me into thinking this is not a very long book, but yeah.
Well, also not being long enough, hence The Apple.
Yeah, which is so cool.
So my question about, so The Apple is the short story collection that came out several years after Crimson Petal?
At least 4 years, wasn't it?
It was 2006, I think.
It was Crimson Petal 2001 or two?
So like a good chunk of time later. My question is, do you think, how many of these stories do you think were just scenes that he had to cut because it was so already so long? Or do you think he really did revisit these characters however many years later?
I think it's probably a mix of both. Like, there were things that he wanted to do that he couldn't, or because of the time, like, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, we had an illicit chat earlier, I'm afraid. It lasted maximum 60 seconds.
Honestly, but, it was nothing. It was just
I'm so sorry. but in it, we did say that, particularly the ones with Sugar, those almost felt like cut scenes where they didn't have the same narrative arc as, say, like Clara and the Rat. Is it the Rat Man?
Rat Man.
Which is an which is my favourite story in the collection, where that feels like it's got narrative arc, payoff, everything. Whereas the ones with Sugar felt like they could have been cut scenes, or just sort of, if not just there, kind of to appease the fans, that you almost, you might not get that much from them if you didn't know who she was. At least that's what I thought.
Because I was thinking, reading this collection, I was kind of half thinking, could you recommend this to someone who hasn't read Crimson Petal? Because I don't think that the things that would be spoilers, I don't think are memorable enough to truly be spoilers. Like, Crimson Petal is just so fucking long.
Yeah.
This is so short. I think if you did read this first, you're not going to necessarily different, you know, the different actions and, like, conclusions to the characters in the book. But then I was like, oh, I'm not sure what the value would be. Apart from Clara and the Rat Man, because it really does exist as an island.
Yeah.
An island that's seared into my brain. Yeah. I will never recover from or forget.
Yeah, and I also, part of it is a bit infuriating in a way that this you know, he includes this foreword where he says that this is basically to appease the many, many fans who've written to him saying that we wanted more, we wanted to know what happened. And yet he withholds so much. So as you say, none of these stories are spoilers, because they don't actually touch on so little. Because we have so many questions at the end of Crimson Petal, and none of them are really answered by this collection.
I think the last story probably does answer more
about what happens
to two of the characters. But even that kind of leaves quite a lot of time unanswered for.
Yeah, and he keeps doing this infuriating thing in the last one where he's like, and where he starts talking about Sugar, and then he goes, oh, but I'm meant to talk about my father back here. And you can just see Michelle Faber kind of cackling into his, you know, laptop or pen and paper or whatever he does, being like, ha ha.
And I felt like the last line of that story was just Michelle Faber saying, like, well, I've had enough of talking about this now, but maybe tomorrow. And there is no tomorrow, Michelle. It's never turned up.
I've just realised we've gone quite far without actually saying, or even attempting, I guess would be better, at explaining what Crimson Petal and the White is, or what it's about. Elizabeth, would you like to try?
Okay. How do I do this book justice? So it's about Sugar, and at the beginning of the book we meet her, and she is a prostitute working on Silver Street, which is sort of a fairly high class brothel. And she's a completely captivating character, and she's visited by William Rackham, who then proceeds to kind of fall for her in a very possessive way, I'd say. And sort of through... I don't think it's a spoiler to say that he sort of pulls her out of that situation. It's about... But there are so many other characters as well, but it's really about her rise and her fight as a woman, and I just loved it. And it's so bawdy. It's such a romp.
That's what I like about it,
is
that it is about a time that when you read book, like the kind of big books from the time, it wouldn't have like any of this stuff in it so explicitly. So it's kind of cool to read the kind of dirty behind the scenes stuff.
Yeah, just, you know, the real nitty gritty, especially because obviously this shit was very present. Like, I'm listening to The Five at the moment.
I really want to read that.
I am loving it.
What is The Five? Who's it by?
Is it Reuben Hold?
Which is about the five canonical victims of Jack the Ripper.
Oh, yes.
We don't
exactly
know how many there were, but the five that we generally consider to be his victims. It's about, it's a history of their lives. It's like a biography describing everything up to the point of their death, but then really not focusing on the death itself. And it's just trying to kind of like rewrite history a little bit and like establish them as like real living people rather than just like their morgue photos. But what I'm really loving about it is that they've done so much research. They're really kind of filling in the like Victorian streets and the kind of people that were there and what certain things would signify to, you know, the people around them. It's like a woman leaving her house without a bonnet or cap
or gloves. Like gloves, that comes up a lot in Crimson Petal and the White. And it's like, I wouldn't know that. Like, exactly. I just wouldn't know that.
But that's what I love about contemporary historical fiction, that it does uncover Victorian era, because it's also what fascinates me about the Victorian era, that on the one hand, you know, it's sort of, on the surface, people see it as sort of genteel, and where, you know, you can't even remove your gloves without people thinking that you're a prostitute, you know, and then underneath it, like in I think it's in the first story, Michelle Faber mentions that, you know, there was one prostitute to every 12 men in Victorian London, so you've got this incredibly seedy underbelly, which just wasn't explored in the same way in literature because of that plight veneer being so emphatic that you couldn't sort of, it couldn't penetrate down into what was really going on. And I love that contemporary historical fiction can go into those details and explore that other side.
Or at least with hindsight as well, kind of be like, what are the things that are interesting and weird about this that I might want to communicate to a reader? Like, how can I sell this as an interesting time period? What are the things? I like that. Like, I like knowing about, you know, if you weren't wearing gloves, you were not going to be recognised as a kind of upper or middle class woman. Like, that is interesting. Yeah. I didn't know that.
Yeah, completely.
The Victorians are my fav.
Yeah.
Whereas I don't really think I'd ever thought about it until I read Crimson Petal and the White. And then I was like, yeah, this is cool. This is
sex
weird.
And death,
yeah.
That's what the Victorians were all about.
Yeah.
And you can also tell different stories there, because I was thinking about, because with my novel, like Crimson Petal and the White is about a woman sort of, I don't know, her quest to be free and her quest to kind of pull herself out of a situation that others, in a way, to become a model, which would have been seen as synonymous with prostitution. And that move being frowned on by others. And if I were a Victorian writer, it would be this sort of cautionary morality tale. And I like that, you know, as contemporary writers like, you know, Michelle Faber and everything, that you can write this plucky, fierce woman who sort of modern day readers can cheer on, but the Victorians sort of would have killed off, as you know, the fallen woman always dies.
So true.
So
yeah, it is. And I feel like within Crimson Petal and White, that's what Sugar is also trying to do with her writing, because she is writing a novel, and in that she's kind of writing this incredibly man-hating, extremely like pro, like almost like sex worker revolution, where they just kill all their clients and torture them. And it's really like, yeah, just being able to kind of rewrite things in a way that I guess feels more right and natural and true to you as a woman or whatever. But you've got to tell us about the Doll Factory. We have talked about this a couple of times, but I don't know if we've ever like laid down the plot, and given that it's out this week, it's a good time for you to tell everyone what your book is about.
So it is set in mid-Victorian London, as we've already established, and it's about art and obsession and possession and collecting. And as I mentioned before, it's about Iris, and she works in this doll-making shop. And it's an existence which is quite stifling, and she longs to escape it to be a painter, because she sort of paints these very weird self-portraits in the cellar of the shop. And then it's about, the other character is Silas, and he's this morbid collector of curiosities. He is quite a fun creation, and he becomes obsessed with her, and it's really about his desire to possess her
as a curiosity,
a sort of, he's so deluded that he almost doesn't know how he sees her himself, so he doesn't know if he sees her as sort of an object or an animal or a love
sexy
interest.
Lady.
Yeah, exactly. So
I feel like it is, if you don't mind me saying, it's like The Collector meets Crimson Petal.
So true.
That is the best,
that is literally it,
pairing ever.
Ex-bookseller mate.
Yeah.
That's my speciality.
I mean, that makes...
I've never read that.
Oh my gosh.
Mate.
I've never read that.
Oh my god, you're in for such a treat. You're going to absolutely love it.
You are.
Cool. Okay, good.
Yeah.
God, I'm so jazzed for you.
I'm excited. I love it when a plan comes together.
Yeah. Like, coming next.
Yeah. This is so good. Yeah, no, I've never read that.
It's sort of like The Doll Factory meets Crimson Peppers. But set
okay,
in the
1960s
London.
I'm totally sold.
Yeah.
But in the way that Crimson Petal is very long, mm-hmm. and you could literally spend like weeks and weeks, possibly months, reading it or having it read to you by is it Jill Balkin? Is that her name? Or Jill? Narrator on the audiobook.
The narrator's really good on the Audible.
Whereas.
I thought you meant my husband.
No.
He can follow you around the house, really, don't you?
I feel like the Doll Factory is really, really pacey. It's so, I feel like it could be it's not, you know, particularly short, but it's so, like, zippy.
Oh,
and
thank you.
I loved reading it.
Yeah, it was good fun to write, because I prefer to write something which I don't know whether I describe it as pacey, but certainly where things are happening a lot. Because that's just more fun for me as a writer. And then it sort of takes the stress off the prose in a way where I know that the story is turning, at least. But that makes me really happy, because all I wanted to do was write a book which people find entertaining, I guess.
It's so entertaining.
I have a question for you. Okay. Yeah. So Crimson Petal is populated with a huge number of characters. Like,
yes.
Everyone from, like, characters that you cross in the street to, like, the main characters who carry the plot. And I feel like the Doll Factory also is very well populated.
Yeah.
How do you go about creating these, like, historical characters that make sense in the scene and the time that they're in with your, like, contemporary brain?
That was hard. And actually, I found the male characters easier, particularly Silas, because he could be sort of this out-and-out misogynist. But it's the characters with more nuance, where, of course, like, Iris couldn't be this sort of proto... She couldn't be this sort of feminist who... A modern-day feminist who would sort of have the vocabulary and means of seeing and expressing misogyny in the way that we do. So I found that difficult to do without sort of... Because obviously it's anachronistic if she marches onto the pages kind of waving this feminist...
Yeah.
banner, but at the same time, I feel that kind of feistiness and fight and a refusal to be cowed is kind of a universal trait. You know, that there are women throughout time who've been like that, like, you know, and Mary Wollstonecraft's Her Rights of Women, which was, is that 1792? I don't know. It was pre-Victorian, clearly. And yeah, I just felt that it had to be society which condemned her, whereas modern readers, again, you've got that filter where we can celebrate it, but you have to have the society kind of, like, her, when she moves to become an artist slash model, her parents condemn her choice, and a charwoman snubs her, and her sister will not speak to her again. And so I guess that the difficulty, it was difficult, and she went through lots of drafts kind of getting her right. And also her love interest, Louis Frost, you know, he couldn't be this sort of feminist hero. He had to be flawed. He had to have elements of maybe slightly more benign misogyny, but, you know, he couldn't, you know, and you see it in his impulse to rescue her and things like that. But, yeah,
so
it was a challenge.
Did you ever have to change any, moments or behaviours because you realised that they were not in keeping with the time?
Yes. So at the beginning, in an early draft, her move from the doll shop to an artist studio was done a bit too seamlessly. And it was my agent who actually said, there needs to be more opposition. Because at that point, it was just her sister and her parents. And that was when I introduced the charwoman who was saying stuff. And, you know, just kind of restricting her movement and her ease of getting around, I guess. So, yeah, it was good fun to write, though. I'd like writing about, you know, freedom and someone who just wants to express themselves creatively and personally.
She's such a memorable character.
Oh, thank
you. She really is. I feel like she's, you know, has a lot about her.
And her sister, like, she has this sister who is very badly kind of scarred by smallpox. And I just feel like I really can understand how, like, that change from being, like, the beautiful sister to, like, the ugly sister would really, like, warp your relationship. And I really like that. I found that very, like, believable in a sad way.
Yeah, because in Vanity Fair, there's, after Becky Sharp has basically made every man in the household fall in love with her when she's governess, and married, you know, Rawdon Crawley, there's a letter from Mrs. Pinkerton's Academy where it says, we can send you another governess. And she, you know, she won't be anything like Becky Sharp. There's no risk of her seducing people because she's, you know, terribly ravaged by smallpox scars. And I just thought, in a society where beauty was your currency and women didn't have, you know, the abilities to raise themselves up through their own professions, really, when really the rises came through marriage, you know, just how utterly screwed you'd be if, you know, moving from being very beautiful, having all of these prospects, to kind of them being wiped out overnight and what that would do to you.
And so, also that kind of is what, in a way, like, is one of the arcs of Crimson Petal and the White, is the way that Sugar would never really have been able to do anything without William.
Yes.
Even though ultimately that does not necessarily prove to have been good overall, but
yeah.
The alternative would have just been have this same life forever. So, okay, so a question that I was thinking about when I was reading Crimson Petal and White, when I was reading The Apple, was who would you, of any of the characters in Crimson Petal and the White, who would you most like to read a kind of spin-off novel about?
Emmeline Fox.
Yeah.
I love Emmeline.
She's so interesting. So
I can't do a spoiler. Nearly did a spoiler. But also Henry Rackham.
Yes. So this is... Henry Rackham is William Rackham's brother.
He's incredibly hairy.
Yep, we know that.
And he believes that his lust is an evil thing. And that is why he is hairy.
His lust for Emmeline Fox.
Yes.
Oh, so he's so horny, he's hairy with it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I don't know where he read it, but this is a thing that he has internalized from reading something.
If and that's true, then all of my lust is, like, manifest just on my upper lip.
But Emmeline Fox is the daughter of a doctor.
A really creepy doctor who...
A bad man.
...preys on Agnes.
Yeah.
Who is William Rackham's wife?
There's just so many characters. Yes. It's very hard to explain
it.
Yeah.
But they're amazing, and it never feels overwhelming. Like, it doesn't feel like a novel where you need a cast list at the beginning.
Because they're so
exactly
well differentiated.
I was going to say, there is no cast list at the beginning, and as soon as I see that, I do think, oh, I'm going to struggle.
No, yeah. I can't. I've never read a book with a cast list which I've enjoyed, apart from War and Peace.
Light Years by Elizabeth Jane Howard.
Oh, I haven't read that.
That's very good. That has
okay.
a cast list.
Do
but that's
you
be-
need the cast list?
Only because they're all from the same family, so they all have the same last names, and there's like three brothers, and at
yeah.
the beginning, before you've differentiated who they are, it can be a little bit confusing.
Actually, I feel like I need to throw in a caveat now, is that I often don't look at them anyway. So if I have previously said I love a book that has a cast list in the front...
You stand by that?
I stand by it. I don't like to see them, but it doesn't mean that, you know,
yeah,
the book
yeah.
is bad.
Do you know who I would love, like, who my very favorite bits of Crimson Petal and the White, actually I enjoyed it slightly less in The Apple, was Bodley and Ashwell.
Oh really?
Yeah.
Oh, I find them so infuriating.
Yeah, I love them.
Yeah.
They're the Victorian version of like Newman in Seinfeld, Bevers in Broad City, like these kind of stupid, like, kind of destructive force. Like, whenever they
yeah.
enter a scene or a space, you know that, like, they're going to do something annoying. They're just,
yeah.
they're the friends, they're the long-time best friends of William Rackham, who's one of the main characters. They don't pop up that often, but when they do, they're always drunk, they're always looking for a brothel, they're always, like, causing trouble. They're publishing these idiotic books that no one buys.
Yeah.
They're just, like, completely destructive forces that are enabled by... the fact that they're like rich men.
And I like them more as the book progresses, because William Rackham becomes increasingly unlikable.
Yeah.
So when they then send him into a spin, you know, you kind of want to set him off track. So yes, now I remember.
I just find them so funny.
Yeah,
they're just so perfect in
I
their
did
stupidity.
Enjoy in The Fly and its effects upon Mr. Bodley. This man basically walking into these women's place of work to talk about his existential crisis.
Yeah, yeah.
I just be like, oh, fuck off.
Yeah, yeah. I think we all know men like, you know,
yeah.
Ashley and Bodwell. Is that their names?
Bodley and Ashwell.
Bodley and Ashwell.
Yes.
Yeah.
Interchangeable.
Yeah, yeah, which they are. Like, they're
yeah.
not differentiated
yeah.
in any way. They are literally like Tweedledum, Tweedledee.
And they don't need
yeah.
to be.
They
yeah.
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 Yeah, I find them very fun. And would like to just see the world through their eyes.
Mm.
These idiot men who can just kind of sail through and cause trouble all the time.
And Mrs. Castaway.
Yeah, I want to know more about her because she is pretty
nasty.
She's the brothel owner and potentially still Sugar's mother.
I think definitely Sugar's mother, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, she likes cutting out religious icons and sticking them in scrapbooks or sticking them around the parlour.
Who doesn't?
Yeah. I just feel like there's so many of those characters and, like, details that make it feel really real.
And it's so imaginative, you know, just, you know, you can just... I just really admire Michelle Faber, you know, what a genius. You know,
I think it's like the kind of book that I would describe as an achievement.
Yeah.
Like a true achievement.
Yeah.
I don't know what accolades it won or what prizes or where it listed or any of that, but it's one of those books that is just, it is almost an overwhelming reading experience.
Completely.
Because it's just so rich and so compelling. And also, I feel like he's the only author probably on the planet that could get away with speaking to the reader the way that he does.
Yeah.
Like, he breaks the fourth wall, you know? And, like,
constantly.
You've obviously listened to it in audio, and it's read by a woman.
Yeah.
So I imagine it in, like, more of a kind of, hello. You know, like, I see this little, like, cap-tipping, hello, madam. Come into my little world full of dirty things.
It's a bit like Vanity Fair, the narrator in Vanity Fair.
I haven't read Vanity
Fair. I have it on audiobook, but I haven't listened to it,
okay,
so
well,
I will.
Well, he breaks the fourth wall then, except I went to a Michelle Faber event, And I asked him about Quiz Pat and the White and Vanity Fair, and he said, I've never read it, I've hardly read any Victorian fiction, I spent all of my life just listening to Hungarian punk. And I thought, what an absolute dude. So
yeah,
he just claimed he'd never read any Victorian fiction, just sat down and wrote this absolute
He must have done an enormous amount of research.
There's a huge amount of non-fiction research, like Henry Mayhew. You can tell that he has, like, combed Henry Mayhew, because I read a lot of Henry Mayhew. And there was so much Mayhew when I was listening to Crimson Petal. So, there we go.
Because that's what's... I love reading books like Doll Factory and Crimson Petal and the White. As in, very, very good historical fiction. I'm the kind of person that I'll only read it if it's, like, really great. I feel like you're possibly the same, Alice.
Yeah. Well, I went through a Victorian phase when I was about 21, 22. No, you're maybe younger than that, like 19, 20. And I read basically every contemporary Victorian novel that was, like, in Waterstones at the time. So I was less discerning.
Wow.
And I feel like the cream really stayed with me.
Yeah.
Quite a few of them have just completely fallen out of my head.
Yeah. So what's another one you love?
So obviously Sarah Waters.
Yeah. Fingersmith.
Fingersmith. That's so good.
Fingersmith is our favourite?
Yeah, I think.
Of the Sarah Waters.
Yeah.
Yeah. Also, I just think everyone knows where they were when they read that bit of Fingersmith, where you think you know what's happening, and it turns out you do not.
That is a twist to end all twists.
Yeah,
because
it's
you
so good.
Now I see, like, twist you won't see coming, and you see it coming.
It's like, I will my bit.
Yeah. Try me. Just try me.
And that is just... And also I liked it, because I think it was also... It wasn't marketed as, like, the twist to end all twists. And so it made it all the more satisfying.
I think, you know, with books like that, it really kind of expands the possibilities of what... I mean, I know lots of people are doing this, but for me it was like, oh, like, kind of historical fiction can be really juicy and thrillery and exciting. Like, it doesn't just have to be kind of romance or kind of dry or whatever.
Well, I think it kind of suffers because historical fiction often will just kind of be branded as historical fiction with no kind of further classification. And obviously there's a big difference between... I mean, then also you've got then time periods within that bracket.
Mm.
But then you have genre within, you know, threading through it all. And I think a lot of people will overlook historical fiction because they'll look at something like Bringing Up the Bodies and Wolf Hall, which I haven't read. Everyone who's read them says they're the best books they've ever read.
Yeah,
they are like
books.
Absolute fucking...
Tomes.
Yeah, they're like tombstones.
Yeah, like, good luck carrying that for 3 years while you're reading it, you know?
Yeah.
And I think that is kind of an intimidating thing. And then on the flip side, you have stuff which looks a little bit kind of trashier, like your kind of beachy bodice ripper style writing.
Like Philippa Gregory.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. But that's... Because we were chatting earlier, obviously, about how... You know, lots of these historical novels are really contemporary, and that historical novels are kind of more about now than they were then. like uncovering the past in a way that could never have been uncovered at the time. And that's what I sort of don't get, that historical is sort of lumped as this huge thing where it can be like immensely contemporary, and influences can be contemporary as well. Like, I don't know, I was really influenced by The Hand That First Held Mine by Maggie O'Farrell.
Oh, and you recommended that book to me. Yeah, of all places, and Hamster Ponds.
Yeah, when we were sculling around, hanging on to the boys. It was idyllic.
Chatting about books.
And the historical is seen as sort of, as you say, its own kind of category, which where there are so many different kinds of books in it, and actually sometimes it can put people off rather than
draw them in.
Yeah.
So I feel like the thought I started with, which has then we then have this
have
very interesting conversation. No, I'm very glad we did. But my question was going to be, when I read these really good historical novels, which I really enjoy, my secondary thought is like, I could literally never be fucking bothered to write one. How do you go about research? Like, it feels like such a massive burden to take on. How and why?
Well, like Alice, I've read so much contemporary historical fiction, and also fiction from the era. So I've read, you know, when I was a teenager, I was obsessed with it. So I read, you know, Hardy, Bronte, Eliot, you know, George Eliot, that is, obviously. And I just read so much, and I was really fascinated as well by the Pre-Raphaelites. So it didn't feel like I didn't have to do a huge amount of research up front, because I'd already kind of just absorbed a lot through my own reading. So I think that helped, because I think when you do a lot of research up front, which I kind of find a bit when I'm writing my second novel, which needs more research, is often you sort of feel the need to show off, and you're like, look here, a shiny thing, and you know, I spent a week in the British Library reading this book, so I at least need to sort of shoehorn one thing in, otherwise that time's wasted. Whereas I kind of, with The Doll Factory, it meant that it was easier for me to kind of withhold and only put stuff in when I felt that it was relevant to the plot. But as I went, I did a lot of research. There's an amazing book called the PRB Journal, which was a journal recorded at the time of sort of minutes of the meetings and what they were all up to. And it just contains so much interesting stuff. So
that would be the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood.
Sorry,
for people listening at home who may not know what
the Pre-Raphaelite Brotherhood. So like, it would be, you know, Millais painting a dead cow's head and is stinking out his house, and or, you know, describing the Royal Academy and where Millais' painting Mariana was hung, and that there was this sort of like Frenchman who looked like a monkey who was laughing at it. So, you know, which is just such a funny little fact. So just throwing in those tiny little references. So it was more kind of getting the little bits here and there. And I also listened to lots of audiobooks, as I said, and I read lots, and I could pick out little phrases or kind of interesting images, which I thought would be quite fun, like sort of, I don't know, snuff boxes and varnished boots and everything. So yeah, it was a total delight to research. But I guess my approach to it came from a, you know, a good decade of Victorian obsession, so that was helpful.
I love it.
I do love it. It's almost daunting though, isn't it? Like, what would you do if you decided, I mean, maybe you just never would, but what if you decided, okay, next book, the plot just really needs to be earlier. Would you just have to start from the beginning? If you decide to do, like, 1666, Fire of London backdrop.
Yeah, and I mean, I think it would be so overwhelming. Like, where do you begin? So,
I guess you have to begin with, like, an interest. I think, was easier for you because you were already well-versed in it and interested in it.
Yeah.
And it wasn't, like, a random coincidence that you were, like, this is when I'm going to set my novel. Like, it kind of appealed to what you wanted to write anyway.
Yeah, and I even did my dissertation on clutter in 1850s literature.
Oh, I love that.
Which was so fun.
Yeah.
It's the texture that makes the time period feel real, you know? Like, it's not so much just the basics of, like, what the world looks like, but it's the little fiddly bits, the detritus and the smells and, like, the odd characters who you pass in your characters will pass in the street, and what they will be able to read about them, you know, like, based on what they're wearing or the details of their clothing.
Because, like, it kind of doesn't matter, not only to Sugar, but to William Rackham, to Iris, to anyone in your book or in The Apple or Crimson Petal and the White. It kind of doesn't matter who the monarch is, who the prime minister is. Like, that isn't, you know, we kind of think of it as, like, the Victorian period, but it's just almost a coincidence that that's who was the queen, and that's like not at all relevant to the actual, like the stuff that's relevant to your lives is like what the sanitation situation is like, what the medical situation is like, what the kind of social proprietary situation is,
or what false teeth were made of,
exactly. Which is very relevant, very relevant to a sweet little character from the doll factory
with no teeth,
who has got no teeth.
God love him.
A little angel.
You'll meet him if you read the book.
Which
you'll
should. But this isn't actually your first book.
No, it isn't.
It's not the first book you've written, but it is the first book that is being published.
Exactly.
Tell us about that, if you want to.
Oh, no, I'm quite happy to. So before The Doll Factory, I wrote two novels, which I wrote in my early 20s. I think I must have been about 23 and 25, and they were turned down by publishers. And I think that's quite a normal experience. So at the time, I did feel quite crushed. I'm really glad that they weren't published, because I think, I don't feel like they're kind of these undiscovered masterpieces like, I don't know, Hilary Mantel's got in her drawer or something, but they were right to be turned down, because they were kind of me just working things out, really. Like Mark Haddon, because he had a large number rejected before Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, and I heard him talking about how it felt like he was kind of in the engine room tinkering about and working out how plot works, character, pace, all of these things, and then he could go and write The Curious Incident. And I kind of felt the same with this novel, because I remember when my other two novels went out on submission, I wasn't that hopeful, and when they were turned down, even though I was really disappointed, part of me actually felt relieved. And I went for a coffee with my tutor the day before The Doll Factory went on submission, my old tutor from UEA, and I said to him, if this novel gets rejected, I'm going to feel really gutted, because it felt like it was the best novel I could write. That doesn't mean it's the best novel, but it was the best I could do, and I knew that. Whereas the others, I felt like I had something better that I was, I don't know, too inexperienced to kind of write.
Which is a legitimate feeling. Yeah, I feel like that's like entirely legit. Like, you knew even then that you had more to come.
Yeah, that I just needed to learn a bit more, and I needed to go to UEA like Alice. And, you know, we were several years apart, but that I needed to kind of learn the basics of it.
Paced the same corridors there.
We did. Haunted them.
But I feel like, because we love an overnight success story.
Yeah.
But, I mean, I say we, I fucking don't. I like to hear about the...
So do I.
I like to hear about not just the rejections. It's not like... It's not some kind of weird schadenfreude thing. It's more like that hearing about the building blocks that have gone into the books that we end up reading. Like, this book couldn't have existed without those two books, even though maybe nothing, they have nothing in common.
Exactly. Completely. And, when I hear these stories, I find them so reassuring, because they're also human. You know, like, the idea that someone just sits down at their desk and sort of bangs out this perfect novel in a month, you know, that would make me feel sick. You know, if that happens, please don't tell me.
I don't. Bethany Rotter.
Firstly, my novel is not perfect. Secondly, it was more like 3 or 4 months. It wasn't 1 month.
Okay, firstly, it is perfect.
You have to say that. You're my mommy.
It's going to be great. I've got proof and I'm so excited.
Of course you got
proof.
It's beautiful proof.
And I've pre-ordered it. I think I sent you the screenshot.
That's how you support your author friends.
No big deal, Bethany Rotter.
No big deal, Bethany Rotter. Just in case, just on the off chance, anyone who listens to what page you're on is not aware. But I feel like it is nice to know how people got to where they are, and like for every person who gets like million billion pound advance for their first novel that they like spunked out in a month, there are people who had novels rejected, or really struggled to get an agent first time round, or they have had a novel out, which is a different genre, which means that their new one can kind of be more positioned as a debut, or blah, blah, blah. There's all this stuff that we just kind of don't know about, and it's, it's not till you're, like, in the publishing machine that you really kind of see how all this stuff maybe works, or you get to know people, and you hear these stories.
Yeah, and it's so common. Because I remember asking Picador, I said, I kind of wanted to talk about the other two novels, is that okay? And they were like, of course it's okay, it's just not, maybe not that interesting, because everyone's got those stories. And I think that maybe people, everyone does, all of these writers do, or maybe they don't talk about them as much.
That's the thing, because you say that, but right now, apart from people that we know personally, who had novels rejected before they got their debut published? Mark Haddon. Anyone else?
Sebastian Faulks.
Really?
Yeah.
I'd love him, alright?
But then it's like, maybe there are loads of them, we just don't know.
That's what I'm saying.
Sophie McIntosh, because she talked about it at Riff Raff, and she actually talked about it after I talked about my film, and she's like, maybe it's okay for me to talk about mine. And I was like,
I assume that most novelists will have written novels, even if they didn't even
submit them,
or wherever the line ended for that book. I feel like most novelists presumably have written before the book that ends up becoming their book, their debut. But I don't feel like it's something that people talk about. Maybe because it's not that interesting to people outside of the writing world. Maybe we're just really interested because we write, and I don't know.
Because I do find it very interesting.
I want to know what it was, what was wrong with it, what you change now.
Yeah, but because people are interested in writers and their lives. I'm really interested in writers and their lives. And yeah, you're right. I often don't. I know sort of about them in the present, but often they don't talk about that stuff before. So
unless, of course, sometimes then they will publish the previously unpublished,
which
books.
I will not be doing.
sometimes that's also a shame because, like. Yeah. You know, I'm thinking, who am I thinking of now? There's someone on the tip of my tongue whose first book was later published and it was just garbage. Shit, here is it. I'm not trying to be coy if I could remember. It was someone really big.
Interesting. But
someone who did have their book, which had been rejected, published, which wasn't crap, was Hilary Mantel.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
What was it called? I think it was set in Africa. Oh, I can't remember its title. But that was published after she became a sensation and that being turned down, but as I say, that is emphatically not my two novels.
I feel like it was something that I'd see at Waterstones quite regularly, suddenly you'd have like a book that pops off and then suddenly all these paperbacks with similar covers would come out. And sometimes it would be their first books that had just kind of not done as well, but often it would be stuff that they had written previously
back in the day
that wasn't that great. So they'd just like hurry them out.
But yeah, I'm always like nerdishly interested in hearing about like people's writing process and people's publishing experiences and blah, blah, blah. And I feel like, yeah, I don't care if some people that listen to this podcast don't want to hear about the, you know, all of the, how the sausage is made. I want to chat about it with people.
And Phil here is like immensely relatable and human.
Yeah, you know. It's true.
No one likes you more than when you're screwing up. So,
yeah.
Isn't that depressing?
I don't know. I just think people are more... It's easier to kind of see someone as like you if they know that you don't have this like unique superhero quality of being able to do something amazing first time with like no, almost what seems like no effort.
Yeah.
That's the thing about really great writing, isn't it? Is that it feels... I mean, for me anyway, really great writing reads like it was effortlessly written. That there's nothing that captures you, it just goes smoothly and beautifully from beginning to end. And that's fucking hard. That's a lot of sanding, you know?
Yeah.
A lot of sanding down of joins and cracks. And
a lot of collaboration too. Mm-hmm. A lot of professional people who've made it that way as well. Editors and agents.
Yeah, I almost want to like sit Michelle Faber down and be like, how? Like mechanically how? Like you have this 850 whatever page novel with incredible amounts of detail. Like, how did you do it? Like, how long did it take you? Was it difficult?
Don't fob me off.
It took a really long time.
Give me specifics.
I think it did take him about 20 years.
Okay, that makes me feel better.
That he started a very, very long time ago, and I think he was working on other novels as well.
I
remember reading that it took him ages, and also his wife. He talked a lot about his wife who died, and he wrote the book of poems Undying about her, about how pivotal she was as an editor to him, which must be a great and useful thing.
Yeah, it's true.
So, you know what, 20 years.
Yeah, fine. Fair play to him. Yeah. I mean, you after
it
20
makes
years.
Me like him more.
Yeah, so, you would turn out a perfect 850-page book after 20 years. I hope. I hope that even though I'd have had to start writing it when I was like 9, but you know, irrelevant.
It's coming.
Yeah. Any day now.
Yeah, well, 2039.
Yeah, if I start now, maybe I'll finish it before the planet sets itself on fire.
I was thinking about reading Ulysses. It's not going to happen. I started that 10 years ago,
I've never even been tempted to pick it up.
I feel really chilled. You don't need to. I just feel like as long as you read the like beginning, the cheese sandwich scene, and then like the end chapter, and you're done.
You've basically read it.
Yeah.
But the other thing I find really weird about Michelle Faber is I've read only one other of his books, and it's Under the Skin, which almost couldn't be more different.
All of his books are different.
Yeah, that's what I get the feeling, he's not...
And the Book of Strange New Things, that's kind of fantasy. He just writes whatever the hell he wants, and I kind of admire that.
A true artiste.
Yeah,
like, totally. What a dude. Like, I love that. But yeah, I cannot relate to that in any way. I'd feel like once I've done something, it means I know I can do it kind of again, so I just keep doing the same thing.
Yeah, well, my second novel is set in the 19th century.
Yeah.
I always struggle with, like, that 19th to 18th thing. I'm like, 1800, but 19th century, and maybe let's not put that in.
No, we all feel like that.
I have to actually add one in my head.
Yeah.
Just the other day I mentioned something about, I think because I was talking to my husband about the five and I mentioned the 19th century and he went, I think you mean 20th, to troll me. I nearly ripped his fucking dick off. I was so angry. I was like, how dare you try and call me something that you know I struggle with.
So rude. So what other... Okay, so we've talked a lot about our beloved Crimson Petal and the White.
Yeah.
Crimson Petal and White, great novel. The Apple, amazing great novel. Set of short stories that follow around Crimson Petal and the White characters.
Yeah.
What are your other faves of this genre?
Oh.
They don't have to be as good as this, but, you know.
Yeah, that's... Well, Fingersmith.
Fingersmith by Sarah Waters, which is just...
I'm anxiously scanning my bookshelves.
I mean, they are kind of the...
Tulip Fever.
I'd love to read that. I've never read
Tulip
that.
Tulip Fever is excellent. Deborah Mogah.
Did that come out in, like, the 90s?
I think it did.
I vaguely remember it, like, my parents reading it.
It's a very slim book, but what she does incredibly well, she turns scene so effectively. I don't understand how it's so slim and goes into so many perspectives and creates such a sort of rip of a book. So I'd really recommend that.
That's a good rec.
I think I can't remember which century it's set in. I think it's 17th century Holland.
Yeah, I think that makes sense based on what I know about history.
Yeah, it is, and it's just brilliant. And that's about obsession as well, because I think obsession is such an interesting thing to read and write about. Because
it's so compelling.
It's so compelling because the character just really wants something. And ambition is just kind of a fascinating thing, I think. And just...
Because whether or not it's actually good for them...
It doesn't necessarily need to be good, and it doesn't need to be... Because in The Doll Factory, of course, Silas's obsession is not a good one, but Iris is obsessed with art, and to a degree Louis, and, you know... And Albie is obsessed with getting his teeth. And, you know, just... all of these kind of ambitions kind of
big or
rubbing
small.
Off against each other. And you've got the same in Tulip Fever. There's an artist in that as well, actually. And then, of course, everyone becomes obsessed with these tulip bulbs, which become... they're worth an absolute fortune and...
Bitcoins of the 1600s.
So, it's just an absolute banger of a book.
That then makes me think of another one of my favourite historical fiction novels is A Girl with a Pearl Earring.
Yeah, that's what another a classic. Wonderful one.
Guess who hasn't read it?
Oh,
it's Bethany Rother.
Again, you're in for a treat. It's just, it's much kind of quieter, I would say, than some, the other books that we've discussed. Like, it definitely doesn't feel as, like, thriller-esque.
Yeah.
But my God, it is just so compelling. It's so gripping.
It's very beautiful. It's sort of it feels like a painting in itself, which of course I guess is the point. But
yeah, it's still not like as ponderous, you know.
Yeah.
Like it still has like
a lightness,
direction.
Yeah,
yeah, like it does. You know, you still be kind of driven forward, but it has. This,
it's
like,
very self enclosed, I suppose.
Yeah,
because the other books we're talking about have this very rich and varied cast, whereas The Girl in the Pearl Earring feels sort of as simple as that painting with just this woman looking out.
It's kind of the what's going on in the darkness around her. You know?
Yeah, exactly.
Behind closed doors, etc.
I think those are all very, very good recommendations, because I as someone who have read a lot of books, have not read some of those. So, you know, maybe
treats
this
in
is
store.
Treats in store for me. Maybe treats in store for our good friends listening at home. I feel like we've kind of covered a lot. Is there anything else that we want to discuss that we haven't put on the record already? Any questions for Elizabeth? Anything Elizabeth would like to talk about that we have not given her the opportunity to talk about?
No, I'm
You feel
just,
satisfied
I feel
with
satisfied.
This experience?
I've really enjoyed it because it's just really fun to chat about books.
It's what we'd be talking about anyway.
And especially Michelle Faber, who, as I say, has been living in my head for quite a long time. It's been quite cathartic, so...
I feel like I would... I think Crimson Petal and White is one of those books that I would recommend to anyone that likes books.
Anyone.
If you have ever read a book and enjoyed it in your life... You will probably like Crimson Petal and White.
And be excited, not deterred by the length.
Yeah.
Because by the time you get to the end, you won't want it to end.
That's the thing, I was going to say, like, it's also not necessarily a book that I would feel intimidated to start. Like, don't save it for a time when you have lots of reading time. Like,
don't worry about that.
You will get through it. I'm saying this, but I didn't
And your life will be put on hold.
Because I thought, it's just so long, I couldn't bring myself to commit. But by the end of this conversation, I'm probably going to use a little Audible credit on it.
I think more than anything, I would say it is an excellent choice for an Audible credit because it's really long. That means you get your money's worth.
Bang for your buck.
It's real bang for your buck. And you just enjoy it so much. It's just pure pleasure. And Doll Factory. So this episode will come out on a Monday, which means that Doll Factory will come out a mere few days after this episode drops.
So it's coming out tomorrow.
Tomorrow!
Oh my god!
Which will be today by the time people listen.
I'm not ready.
So it's out on Thursday.
It feels like Graham Norton when we've got to pretend that we're sort of here on a specific night. And we're like, we're here on New Year's
Friday.
Eve.
It's exactly like being on Graham Norton.
It's Monday morning at 7 a.m.
Yep, in Bethany's home next to her laptop while she's uploading it. So Doll Factory by Elizabeth McNeil, out on Thursday from Picador, the good people at Picador. It is excellent. We've talked about it several times on this esteemed podcast.
We'll talk about it several times more.
I'm sure it will come up again in our lives. I would strongly recommend everyone listening at home buys it, especially if you like any kind of historical fiction, but you like books that are also fun. Mostly, do you like fun books? Yes. Thank you so much for joining us, Elizabeth.
Thank you. It's been such a treat. And now let's eat biscuits.
There's a couple of biscuits left. See you next time.
Bye.
Bye.